lobbyists and also corporate donations to the DNC, and that resolution was voted down. And actually, a lot of the very same arguments that were used at the DNC were used at the RNC over the summer when a few reformist Republicans tried to put up a similar resolution. You know, they said, hey, you'll be banning farmers and pastors and people who represent domestic violence, you know, clinics. All these things are complete nonsense, of course. But I think what you saw was both parties have an addiction to an establishment and to people who have a rooted sort of sense of power and a sense of privilege, and they're refusing to sort of turn over power to the grassroots. So when the Democrats asked for Bernie Sanders' email list, I mean, it's not like, you know, Cory Booker can use that list and someone who gave $10 to Bernie Sanders is going to be enthusiastic about giving money to someone who, you know, votes with big pharmaceuticals or someone who votes with Wall Street or someone who, you know, helped smear Keith Ellison for his very moderate views on Israel-Palestine. I mean, I don't think that list is a magic tool for the Democratic Party. If they want small donors like that giving to them, then they should sever the link to the big donors. No one's going to be, you know, no one who's poor or working class is going to give you money and they feel like their money isn't going to influence
just
the big donors.
Zed, we have 5 seconds. The significance of Ellison being made the deputy co-chair of the DNC, a new position.
Well, it's not a position in the bylaws. It seems like sort of an advisory role. But, it's probably positive that he'll be staying in Congress now.
I want to thank you for being with us. Zed Jelani of The Intercept will link to your piece. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Democracy Now! Produced by a remarkable group of people. Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gatas, Dina Gezder. Thanks for joining us.
Open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
KABU with the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month we're celebrating Fat Tuesday on Tuesday, February 28th, with the Les Blank films Always for Pleasure and Dry Wood. Les Blank sat at the kitchens and on the porches of Creole folk in the Delta to capture their Mardi Gras spirit and traditions to make the film Dry Wood. Les filmed Always for Pleasure, documenting the 1970s carnival celebrations in New Orleans. Again, that's a night of films by Les Blank to celebrate Fat Tuesday, February 28th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, hundreds of demonstrators protested today at the ICE building in Portland at the Coming Out of the Shadows, Undocumented, and Unashamed rally.
Residents of the Cully neighborhood in Northeast Portland marched Saturday to protest an announced 100% rent increase for the Normandy apartment complex.
And the U.S. Justice Department is dropping out of a lawsuit that seeks to overturn the Texas state voter ID law.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, February 27th, 2017. I'm Rosalyn Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Residents of the Cully neighborhood in Northeast Portland marched Saturday in protest of an announced 100% rent increase for the Normandy apartment complex located at 26th and Northeast Killingsworth. Almost 500 protesters marched from the apartment complex to the nearby Rigler Elementary School, where children living in the apartment complex make up more than 5% of the total student body population. The apartment complex was sold last December to real estate developers working for a national commercial real estate company. The owners plan to raise the rent from $600 a month to $1,250 a month, an increase of more than 100%, an increase most residents say they cannot afford.
Documents obtained by the Portland Tribune show that Multnomah County Sheriff's Office employees have been illegally assisting federal immigration officials in capturing and deporting undocumented immigrants. The documents show coordination between ICE officials and the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office despite an executive order issued by Oregon Governor Kate Brown earlier this year, prohibiting all state agencies and employees from assisting federal ICE agents from enforcing federal immigration laws. Current state law also prohibits any state or local employee from assisting federal ICE agents in capturing and deporting undocumented immigrants unless they have been convicted of a crime. The documents were obtained by the Tribune through a Freedom of Information Act request to the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. They show that at least three sheriffs coordinated with ICE agents to apprehend undocumented immigrants that had been charged with crimes but not yet convicted. Earlier this month, the governor asked State Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum to sue the Trump administration in federal court over what the governor is calling an illegal ban of immigration from certain Muslim countries. In response last week, Rosenblum formally asked a federal court to be allowed to join a lawsuit against the Trump administration immigration ban filed by the state of Washington. Governor Kate Brown met yesterday with the Director of Homeland Security in Washington, D.C., about the presence of ICE officials at county courthouses in Oregon, stating their presence undermines trust in public institutions and creates an atmosphere of fear.
Several Jewish community centers and Jewish day schools around the U.S. have been the targets of bomb threats recently. Today, 13 community centers and 8 day schools, mostly on the East Coast, received threats and were forced to close temporarily. All have been able to reopen and resume normal operations after law enforcement gave the all clear. So far this year, there's been a total of 90 bomb threats at 73 locations, targeting both community centers and day schools in 30 U.S. states and one Canadian province. Other incidents of anti-Semitism in the U.S. recently include vandalism at Jewish cemeteries. Over the weekend, more than 500 tombstones at a Jewish cemetery in Philadelphia were vandalized, and last week about 150 tombstones were overturned at a St. Louis Jewish cemetery. Many are concerned that the White House has been slow to respond to these incidents. The U.S. Muslim community, on the other hand, has stepped up. An effort by Muslim activists to raise money to help with repairs in St. Louis has already raised more than $130,000, far surpassing the original goal of $20,000. Organizers of that effort say they're now reaching out to Philadelphia to help repair the damage there.
In the last month, a record warm spell broke almost 3,000 daily maximum temperature records. In the last week alone, more than 700 record high temperatures were set with no record lows recorded. On Thursday, a town in Texas hit 107 degrees, the highest temperature ever recorded in the United States in February. Record heat waves are also currently hitting Australia, where temperatures above 120 degrees Fahrenheit have hit numerous towns. This winter has also seen record high temperatures in the Arctic, with some weather stations showing temperatures up to 50 degrees over normal, leading to an unprecedented lowering of sea ice during the winter months.
The Trump administration announced plans to massively cut funding to the Environmental Protection Agency and use the savings to increase military spending. Earlier this month, the White House named Mike Catanzaro as the top White House energy policy aide. Catanzaro was previously a lobbyist for Koch Industries, along with several other oil and gas companies. As chief energy advisor, Catanzaro, a climate change denier, will implement the president's domestic energy and environmental agenda and manage the interagency coordination process. Catanzaro has previously lobbied against regulations that limited methane releases from fracking operations, against offshore drilling regulations, and against regulations that limited oil and gas extraction on public lands. Catanzaro will work closely with new EPA head Scott Pruitt, another staunch climate change denier, who has publicly stated his intentions to gut the EPA. The Trump administration also announced that they'll issue new executive orders this week to cut subsidies for renewable energy and to ease restrictions on coal leasing and mining on federal lands.
The White House says it plans to release a top-line summary of its fiscal year 2018 budget next month. Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney made the announcement at today's White House press briefing. Mulvaney provided very little information about the budget plan, saying that a detailed proposal with dollar figures and policy statements would not be available until sometime in May. Congress is still trying to approve the budget for the current fiscal year, which started on October 1st. Congress and the Obama administration failed to agree on a budget last year before the deadline. To avoid a government shutdown, they passed a continuing resolution that keeps agencies operating at previously approved funding levels. That resolution was set to expire in December. After the election, congressional leadership made an agreement with the incoming Trump administration to extend the continuing resolution until April 28. Congressional committees are meeting over the next few days to try and finalize appropriation bills for the current year, but it's not known whether they will be able to reach an agreement. Meanwhile, federal agencies are already discussing plans for a possible shutdown that would start on April 29th if budget negotiations fail.
The U.S. Department of Justice announced today that it will pull out of a lawsuit challenging a voter ID law in the state of Texas. To learn more, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Anthony Gutierrez from Common Cause Texas.
My name is Anthony Gutierrez. I'm the executive director with Common Cause Texas. So the voter ID law in Texas, this is going back to about 2011. Basically what's happening now is the Department of Justice under President Trump now, and our new attorney general has decided to reverse course and say they no longer feel the law is discriminatory. This sort of flies in the face of what we have been seeing for many years, for I guess about 6 years now in Texas, throughout the course of this litigation. Really no facts of this case have changed. The only thing that has changed here is there's a new political leadership at the Department of Justice, and we at Common Cause are just incredibly concerned and distressed about today's action. The first version of this voter ID law that was passed was in 2011, and it's been being litigated ever since. It is up and going to be up in court again tomorrow, and it's just kind of one of many things in Texas that, when it comes to voting rights, that apparently just has to be litigated, and we have to constantly fight for these things in Texas. Yeah, so it is a little complicated, and I'm sure we'll get more details in the morning. What I believe happened, and it may be able to sort of refine this a little bit better as I get more information, what I believe the Department of Justice is going to say is that they are no longer seeking to fight the claim that the law was discriminatory when it was put into place. And they may not be backing off on saying that the law is discriminatory in effect. And we don't believe that they are completely backing off of their opposition to the law. I think it is just that one piece that's saying that it is discriminatory in intent, which is still a very big deal because that is a huge part of what the case centers upon. There are still several plaintiffs fighting against the law, and everybody is going to be pushing forward. Every court that has looked at this law so far has been finding against the state of Texas. We are optimistic that courts will continue to uphold the, I think the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals was the last one that looked at it and found discriminatory intent. We are hopeful that that's kind of what's going to continue to happen. And at the end of this process, we end up with laws that will make it easier for Texans to vote and not continue to be putting up these barriers between Texans and the ballot box. Looking at this sort of from the grand sort of 10,000-foot view, we in our history as Common Cause, we've been around since the 70s and very rarely have ever opposed the nomination of any attorneys general to their positions. Jeff Sessions was an exception for us, and we took a hard stance against it. And it was because of the fact that he was so opposed to the Voting Rights Act over the course of his career. Seeing this action today, I think, really is exactly what we were worried about. This The voter ID law in Texas is clearly discriminatory, in our opinion. The fact that the Department of Justice under Jeff Sessions is no longer opposing it is just incredibly concerning for us. And, you know, we're going to be continuing to fight this in court, and we'll continue to try to fight against this type of legislation and then new voter ID law bills that are being passed by this legislature right now.
Again, that was Anthony Gutierrez with Common Cause Texas. They and a number of other litigants, including the Texas NAACP, ACLU, and others, are suing the state of Texas over its voter ID law. Should be in federal court tomorrow. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Former Obama Labor Secretary Tom Perez was elected over the weekend to chair the Democratic National Committee. He's vowing to rebuild the Democratic Party while changing the culture of both the party and the DNC. Keith Ellison, the favorite of the progressive Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, urged unity behind Perez, saying Democrats don't have the luxury of being divided. The AFL-CIO says if the leaked draft of the Republican health care plan is the one they go with, it's a non-starter. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the leaked GOP health care plan lowers the health care bar when we should be raising it instead. He says the GOP is lowering America's health care under the guise of reform. Trumka also noted that the Republican plan would slash health care for tens of millions of Americans and impose a new tax directly on America's working people, threatening to destroy the health coverage we earn on the job. The recent victory by the National Nurses United California Nurses Association at Kaiser Permanente after a 17-month struggle has secured a good contract for 1,200 Los Angeles nurses. Another 550 nurses at 21 Kaiser hospitals across Northern and Central California just became NNU-CNA union members. Deborah Berger is co-president of the National Nurses United and president of California Nurses Association. She says the Los Angeles Kaiser nurses were long overdue for a pay raise.
These nurses have been without a pay raise for over 6 years. So this settlement is huge in many, many ways because those nurses have not given up. They continued the struggle, and I am just really proud that they're part of the CNA and NU family.
Berger says the Los Angeles Kaiser nurses made significant gains in this new contract.
What they got was wage gains up to 34% over 4 years. And for the nurses that had not received a pay raise in all of those years, there are some retro lump sum payments for those nurses, which is really precedent setting for nurses that have been without contracts for a long, 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 long time.
The union nurses also ended mandatory overtime with the 550 new union nurses at Kaiser and approval of the Los Angeles Kaiser contract. CNA now represents 19,000 RNs in California.
Sponsored by Iron Workers Impact, now reserving spots for this year's groundbreaking conference, welcoming contractors to grow their business by networking and attending world-class breakouts. More on this event in San Diego, happening March 19th through the 22nd, is found online at impact-net.org under events.
Brought to you by unionjobs.com, posting jobs for unions, socially allied, and community organizations since 1997.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, showers likely, mainly before 10 p.m., mostly cloudy, with a low around 38. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Tomorrow, a 40% chance of showers, mostly cloudy, with a high near 47. Today in history, in 1933, the Reichstag building, which was then home to Germany's parliament, was destroyed by fire. And in 1973, members of the American Indian Movement began their occupation of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, site of the 1890 massacre of Sioux men, women, and children by the U.S. Army. The quote of the day is from American Indian Movement activist and political prisoner Leonard Peltier, who said, "I don't know how to save the world. I don't have the answers or the answer. I hold no secret knowledge as to how to fix the mistakes of generations past and present. I only know that without compassion and respect for all of Earth's inhabitants, none of us will survive, nor will we deserve to.
Recently completed research has revealed more than 25,000 elephants were illegally killed by poachers for their ivory in Gabon's Menkibi National Park over the last decade. The poachers reduced the elephant population in the park by up to 80%. The poaching is being driven by consumer demand, especially from Asia, where ivory is used in traditional medicines. The high demand for ivory products has led to the rise of paramilitary poaching methods, including the use of armored vehicles, helicopters, and machine guns. In related news, more than 1,000 protected rhinos were killed in South Africa last year, marking the fourth straight year of more than 1,000 rhino deaths. More than 95% of all African rhinos live in the neighboring countries of South Africa, Namibia, and Zimbabwe. The rate of poaching is believed to be slightly ahead of rhino birth rates, leading experts to fear a rhino population crash. In more related poaching news, Indian authorities have increasingly issued shoot-to-kill on-site orders for any poachers caught illegally hunting tigers and rhinos in Indian national parks. In the last 3 years, more than 50 poachers were executed in the Kaziranga National Park alone as authorities increasingly respond to poachers with lethal force.
Famines are looming over several dry and war-torn areas in North Africa and the Middle East. The United Nations declared a famine in South Sudan last week and is on the verge of declaring famines in Yemen, Somalia, and northeastern Nigeria as well. While low rainfall in eastern Africa and the Middle East is undoubtedly a crisis in its own right, the situation is exacerbated in all four areas by ongoing armed conflicts. In Yemen, the poorest country in the Arab world, many of its 18 million people are in rebel-controlled territory and subject to frequent air raids from a Saudi-led coalition. Food does not make it in easily, if at all. The causes of the crisis are more complicated than any one thing, however, and local governments and aid organizations are scrambling to raise funds and awareness to avert a catastrophe. Portland-based NGO Mercy Corps works with local organizations in Somalia and the larger region to deliver food and medical aid and work for economic development. For more on how that organization is responding to the unfolding crisis, KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke with Mercy Corps' Senior Communications Director, Lynn Hector.
What's the geographical and human scope of this potential crisis?
So to put the drought in Somalia in context, right now we're seeing global hunger levels at their highest in decades, and about 20 million people are actually on the brink of famine.
To what degree is this overall crisis climate-driven or driven by politics and conflicts on the ground?
The drought in Somalia is really resulting from two consecutive seasons of failed rains across the Horn of Africa during really one of the strongest El Nino events on record. So right now we're heading into what is normally the rainy season that runs April to June in Somalia, but forecasts are suggesting that these April rains are likely to be below normal. And if the rains fail again, we could see a similar situation to what we saw in 2011. And in 2011, Somalia experienced the worst famine of the 21st century, and about 250,000 people died. So to put that in perspective, if you can imagine essentially like half the population of Portland City proper being wiped out due to hunger, that's what happened in 2011, and that's what we're worried about happening again.
Wow. This time around in Somalia, it could be as many as 5 million people affected?
Well, right now, more than 6 million people, which is about half the country's population, are in need of assistance. And that includes about 360,000 acutely malnourished children who really need critical support, including about 71,000 children who will die if they don't get treatment.
As far as Mercy Corps itself, and what sort of programs do you do on the ground in Somalia?
So Mercy Corps has been working in Somalia since 2005, and we've been really focused on helping communities to prepare to better withstand and recover from these types of climate changes. So we distribute food and clean water. We distribute cash vouchers so families can buy what they need. We provide training, education, and economic opportunities for young people. And we also help strengthen local economies and help people sort of restore their own sources of income.
And do you partner with other groups on the ground there?
We do. We always partner with local organizations, civil society groups. We really believe communities know what they need best, and oftentimes we are most effective if we can partner with local organizations who are, you know, embedded and entrenched in the communities where we're working.
And you said you've been speaking over the weekend with some of your people on the ground there, and what have they been seeing?
Well, what we're seeing is shooting prices, increasing prices in for food, for water. We're seeing people unable to find or afford medical treatment for their children. What's important to know about Somalia is that many people rely on livestock for their sources of food and income. And these herders, they move their livestock, so camels, goats, they move around the country in search of water, in search of pastures. And so when you have limited rainfall, you don't have irrigation for crops, you don't have irrigation for your livestock, you can't find vegetation. And so we're seeing livestock dying. About 3/4 of the livestock population in Somalia has already been wiped out. And our team, you know, has really seen labor prices collapsing. They've seen local food prices rising. Food is harder and harder to get.
Do people need to travel a long distance to get to help?
Absolutely. And in fact, what we're seeing is that people are leaving as they can't find water sources, and they're increasingly moving to these displacement settlements in urban areas. And so then you have more and more pressure on these urban areas where there might already be shortages, but you have more people needing food. So that creates tension that, again, affects markets and prices. So it absolutely, we see large displacement.
And so on the aid end of things, where is, for example, Mercy Corps feeling the strain here? It seems like way more people are potentially going to be affected than aid organizations are prepared for. Is that accurate at all?
That is. Last week, the head of the UN said that they need $5.6 billion by March, so just this month coming up, and that's just to avert catastrophe. The UN appeal this year for 2017 is a record level $22 billion to support 93 million of the world's most vulnerable people. And what's important to know is right now, the humanitarian community, including organizations like Mercy Corps, is stretched incredibly thin. While humanitarian funding worldwide has actually risen, it just cannot keep up with the growing level of need. Barely 2% of that money is in hand right now. So the entire community is stretched incredibly thin.
What needs to happen and how quickly?
Well, in the immediate, the international community and governments like the United States need to provide funding for humanitarian assistance to save lives. That funding needs to be dispersed quickly, and it needs to go to international organizations like Mercy Corps with a presence and experience in the region, as well as national and local organizations, like I mentioned before, who really know their communities best and what they need. In the long term, though, we know that meeting urgent needs it's not enough. It's a quick fix and it's important, but we have to lay the groundwork now so that next year or the year after, that people are more resilient and they're better able to cope with what we're seeing as a reoccurring pattern.
Anything you'd like to add?
Well, we are so appreciative of the Portland community and their support of Mercy Corps. We couldn't do the work we do without Portland. So we always encourage you to visit mercycorps.org. We appreciate any donation, and you can visit our website to learn more about the work that we're doing.
I've been speaking with Lynn Hector with Mercy Corps in Portland. Lynn, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
The month of February brought record levels of ceasefire violations in eastern Ukraine, with the city of Avdiivka one of the most affected frontline hotspots. For the roughly 16,000 people living there, that's meant often lengthy periods of time without water, power, and gas. To help offset the anxiety for families in the city, humanitarian aid groups and volunteers are playing a key role in emotional support by providing art therapy, music sessions, and paint workshops. Philip Warwick from Free Speech Radio News reports.
On the outskirts of Avdiivka, a government-controlled city on Ukraine's eastern front line, sounds of weapon fire echo into the night. The 1st of February saw over 10,000 explosions, a new one-day record observed by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, also known as the OSCE, which monitors ceasefire violations. These strenuous conditions in frontline towns during periods of ceasefire violations bring increases in shock and stress to the local population. To help young people cope with conflict-related emotions, Ukrainian-born Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra violinist and volunteer Marina Bondas organizes art therapy music sessions in schools, hospitals, and special care homes for children.
Well, the thing about music therapy, every rhythm, every kind of sound, it has different influence on the mental state, and you can influence this. From this, I choose my repertoire. I start actually with classical music, a little bit Vivaldi, Bach, Mozart, Fritz Kreisler. It's my favorite composer, and he has lovely pieces that are very short and very emotional and very positive, so people can get some hope. And then I play also not classical music, like folk music, Ukrainian, Hungarian, Jewish, every kind of. And then some tango, some jazz, some pop music also.
At the beginning of the month, the city experienced the worst ceasefire violations since the Minsk II agreement, signed in February 2015. Avdiivka local Alexei Savkevich lives in the city's old quarter with his wife and two children. His house is some 2 miles from the front line, and during the uptick in fighting, shells fell near his kitchen. While making tea, he tells me one of Bondas's concerts in the city helped his family to live through this difficult period.
When Marina came to our city during this escalation of the conflict, and we had no electricity and we had no water, for me, these concerts really like give some more power to survive all these events, because music really helps to feel that everything will be good.
Responsible for monitoring ceasefire violations in eastern Ukraine, the OSCE registered last year over 330,000 heavy weapon explosions along the 300 miles long front line. Principal Deputy Chief Monitor of the OSCE mission, Alexander Hug, witnessed how this month's ceasefire violations affected the civilian population on the ground.
And it's often quite amazing to see how they still try to go about their normal ways. They stand at bus stations while the bus station is shaking from incoming shell just a few hundred meters. But if you look at the people and if you talk to them, you can feel the stress, the permanent stress that they're under, a lot of emotion, a lot of agitation.
Born in the Soviet Union but having lived in Germany for the past 17 years, Alan Mayer is a Berlin-based Israeli painter. He organizes art therapy paint sessions in eastern Ukraine and believes art can help children to share their thoughts and emotions, which may otherwise be overlooked. But he also says there are limits to what art therapy can do and help.
First of all, I try not to have illusions about the power of the art. Art is not something that's gonna, by some miracle, save the world and gives the world peace or whatever. I think that art is important. Art is something that makes life more colorful, because there's always people who crave for art more than others. That's just reality. And if those people cannot have this in these areas, that's going to be very sad reality.
21-year-old Zhenya Vasilieva attended one of Mayer's art therapy pain sessions. She describes the children's reaction.
I saw the happiness on their faces, and I was happy too. This format is unusual for this city, and I hope in future we will practice this format of art therapy.
With parents present during the art therapy workshop, Vasilievna says the session had a positive impact for all participants.
In the first day when they did frames, this was like family team building, and children and parents communicate. This is very important for family relationships.
Prior to Mayer's departure from Avdiivka, he says he wants to teach the children the concept of helping themselves. with art therapy paint sessions providing the basics until his next trip to eastern Ukraine.
I leave them with the idea that they can do it themselves. Because everything I do, it's a short lessons. It's not like I sit with them and they draw very slowly, sort of with a pencil. And it's really not something that some person who comes for a short period of time can manage. It's impossible. What I give them impression that the art is something that you can do yourself. You have some colors, some piece of paper, a piece of whatever canvas you can manage as well. And in one day or two, you have a painting that's going to be really beautiful.
A truce between Russian-backed separatists and the Ukrainian army was due to come in force February 20th, but failed to last half a day. While Bondas and Meyer tried to bring some comfort to the children of Avdiivka, the sounds of battle continue on the Eastern Front, with little to suggest change anytime soon. Philip Warwick, FSRN, Avdiivka, Eastern Ukraine.
This Saturday is March 4th, and supporters of Donald Trump have planned a series of events across the country to mark the date and show they're behind the beleaguered chief executive. They're calling it March for Trump. While you'd think there wouldn't be much interest in Oregon, much less the Portland metropolitan area, there's a local event planned for Lake Oswego. It's called Oregon's March for Trump, and it's scheduled for noon on Saturday at George Rogers Park. Organizers expect a few hundred people to show up for the pro-Trump rally. At the same time, there are several activist groups organizing a counter-protest, and they're expecting an even larger crowd will be there to voice their opposition to the Trump administration. We're fortunate to have one of the anti-Trump organizers with us now in the studio, Jacob Barreros of Portland's Direct Action Alliance. Jacob, thanks very much for coming into KABU.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Jacob, first, can you tell us a little bit about your group, Direct Action Alliance?
Yeah, my group, Direct Action Alliance, is actually based out of Portland, and my involvement in this particular one is more in relation to my involvement with Independence for Progressive Action, which is based out of Clackamas. During the last election, when I was working for Dave McTeague, who was primary in Kurt Schrader, and then later on for Ken Humberston, who's the commissioner, we did a lot of work with Independence for Progressive Action, and it became kind of a family in that campaign.
And they were pro-Bernie group, right?
Yes, yes. It was originally Willamette Falls for Bernie Sanders was the name of the group. We poured our heart and soul into getting, you know, Jim Bernard and Ken Humberston and turning Clackamas blue, pretty much.
Now, before we get to the March 4th event, Direct Action Alliance, your group, helped organize a protest earlier today. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned that earlier on the news. It's called Coming Out of the Shadows, and it was at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Building in Portland on McAdam. To set the scene, before we talk a little bit about it, we have some audio from that event, courtesy of KABU reporter Kanan Schlesinger, who was there.
So, real quick, Why this action, right? Why we're outside the ICE buildings there, right? Rápidamente, ¿por qué estamos aquí hoy en frente de la oficina de inmigración, verdad? Rápidamente, como varios ustedes saben, por medio del evento de Facebook, pues pusimos información por qué estamos haciendo el evento. As many as you know, through the Facebook event, we announced why we decided to come out of the shadows outside the ICE building. Como ustedes saben, en los últimos años ha habido un ataque contra la comunidad indocumentada, inmigrante y refugiados, ¿verdad? For so many years, there's been such an attack on our communities, our undocumented community, our immigrant community, and our refugee community. Pero basado en que sabemos que inmigración continúa separando las comunidades, queríamos demostrar que como comunidad ya no queremos tener ese miedo, ¿verdad? For the last couple of years, you know, we've been attacked, but also we want to show eyes that we cannot longer be, we're not going to be afraid of them. That as a community, we're going to continue to fight back. Are we going to fight back? Yeah. Right, we're going to continue to fight back. Rápidamente, mi nombre es Jaime. My name is Jaime. I'm a parent. I'm a mentor. Soy un padre. Soy un mentor. I'm a son. I'm a brother. And I'm also a documented immigrant. And definitely, I'm not afraid. No.
Hi, everybody. Well, I first want to acknowledge everyone that is here undocumented. So thank you for being here. Y'all are my inspiration. Woo! So, hola, I'm Joanna. I'm a person who fights for equity and inclusion. I'm a mentor, a family member, an ally to all of those who are oppressed. Woo!
Buenas tardes, soy Luna Flores. Soy un ser humano que quiere vivir en paz, sin muros, sin fronteras. Soy una madre que quiere vivir en este estado donde conocí el amor, donde mi hija nació y donde mi vida está aquí. La mayoría de mis amigos, los que considero mis hermanos, están aquí y quiero estar aquí con todos ustedes.
Hello, my name is Suli. I am a daughter, a sister, a friend, a mentor, a student, but most importantly, I'm a human being.
I'm Carla Castañeda. I am undocumented. I am unafraid. I'm an activist, an organizer, and a feminist.
Hello, everybody. Well, hola a todos. Mi nombre es Petrona. My name is Petrona. I am a daughter, a student, a fighter, an activist, a mentor, and most importantly, I am documented. I am legal. Regardless of what anyone will ever tell me, I do belong here. Yeah.
A mother, daughter, grandmother, and I'm afraid.
Mi nombre es Juan Manuel Ábalos, soy un hermano, soy un hijo, soy un estudiante, un trabajador y alguien que está peleando por sus derechos y por su comunidad esta tarde. Gracias.
That was audio from KBOO reporter Kanan Schlesinger, who was at the ICE building earlier today, and you heard some very moving accounts from immigrants at the protest. Jacob, you weren't there, you told me, but your group had a part in organizing it. What was the purpose of the protest?
Well, I just want to clarify as well. We did not have a part in organizing it or anything. What we do is we boost these events because we do work with Voz Hispania Cambio Comunitario, which is based out of Woodburn, and other groups. And this is something that we are very passionate about. And it's something that we definitely use our network to boost. So while I did not take part in planning it, it's something that we endorse very heavily at Direct Action Alliance. And understandably, the purpose of it was, you know, exactly as the title said, to come out of the shadows for too long, the oppressor, which is ICE. It's basically the Gestapo of modern day. They come and they tear families apart. And they take away good people and they ship them back because they crossed imaginary lines that made them illegal human beings. And it's despicable. You know, it goes against the very nature of migration that has been in the human DNA since the very beginning. And
certainly in the U.S. DNA.
Yeah, exactly. And the purpose of the event was to show ICE that we are united, we are a strong front. Today I had my kids and one of them is very ill, so I wasn't able to make it out. But so many people came out to make that statement that no human being is illegal. You know, these undocumented immigrants and documented, which are folks who fall under DACA, have been really living with this fear that at any moment, you know, they could come and get their entire realities kind of flipped upside down by this arbitrary authority that says that they've done something wrong because they don't carry the right papers, something that we saw happen in Germany. Something, you know, it's despicable and it's disgusting and it shouldn't be happening in our country.
Jacob, can you briefly explain DACA for our listeners who might not know?
Yes, DACA is the legislation that was passed by Barack Obama. He's got executive order.
Right.
That basically, if you were brought here as a child, undocumented, that you would be protected, that you wouldn't be shipped off, and it's the law of the land. And we have already seen violations of this take place, and it's ridiculous. So, what DACA is the protection for the Dreamers to keep them in this country. You know, this is the only place that they know. This is their home. They've lived here from whenever they came over, and you know, it's just ridiculous that even they are being attacked under this legislation. Literally, people who don't know anything else but this land are being shipped to places that they've never seen before, to be with people they've never seen, if they have people. You know, it's really dehumanizing, and it's something that all Americans should be very, very avidly fighting.
And do you know of any future protests planned, immediate future of ICE and the Trump administration's immigration policies?
Yes, there are actually three really important rallies coming up. They're being organized by Voz Cambio Comunitario and Milenio. And the first one is tomorrow, actually, and it's the Latinx rally. And it's to defend DACA. And it's also announcing our state and city demands of our elected officials. And that one is going to be tomorrow at the Terry Shrunk Plaza.
Oh, that's downtown.
Yes, right. It's downtown on Southwest Madison. And that is tomorrow. And we're asking everyone to come out and support us. And on March 6th, there's going to be another one called ICE Out of Oregon Rally. And that one is taking place at the ICE headquarters.
On McAdam.
Exactly. And being put on by the same organizations, Milenio en Voz. And then the next one is going to be on March 7th, the very next day after the one at ICE. And this one's going to be in Hillsboro. And it's at the Civic Center in Hillsboro. And we're asking everyone in Portland, all the allies, to come out and support our neighbors out in Hillsboro who are really being threatened right now. They don't have the same resources, the same protections, you know, or perceived protections that folks, you know, could feel more comfortable about out here in Multnomah County, and they really need our support. So we're standing by those organizations and by these groups, and we're pouring all of our resources into spreading the word about this as well. And we're asking all of our supporters to go out and support these events. We will be there to hold hands and stand shoulder to shoulder with our neighbors and our friends.
Oh, thanks for letting us know about that.
Yeah.
I want to get to Saturday's March for Trump and the counter-protest. You're kind of doing double duty for us.
No worries.
Right now. What is March for Trump for maybe listeners who haven't heard about it yet?
March for Trump is this nationwide call for supporters of Trump to march.
On March 4th.
Yes, it's a very, you know,